morning. Please be seated. All right, we have two cases on our 10:30 docket. We'll call in here the first one, N. Re. ASD. We'll have to take a brief recess at that point when we finish this one, and we'll go on to the next case. We need a panel change for our last case. If the clerk will please announce counsel for the parties.
May it please the court. Parental rights are more precious than any property right, which is why the courts must consider the termination of parental rights very seriously. The trial court in this case based the termination of the mother's parental rights to the child on the grounds D, E, and O found in the Texas Family Code and ruled that such termination was in the child's best interest. The appellant does not believe that the evidence presented at the trial court supports that determination. Regarding the grounds of D and E, the relevant inquiry is whether evidence exists that the endangerment of the child's physical or emotional well-being was the direct result of the parent's conduct, including acts, omissions, and failure to act. And this must be based on more than a single act or omission, a voluntary, deliberate, and conscious course of conduct by the parent is required. That is from N. Re. MCT. This is a snapshot in time looking backwards. So in this case, anything following the removal of the child in July of 2009 is not to be considered for the grounds of D&E. The evidence presented at the court would show that the mother had no foreknowledge of the alleged perpetrator of the harm to the child and had no warning that the harm would come to the child. And therefore, there is no evidence that the mother's conduct or omission caused the harm to this child or placed this child in any physical danger.
How do you respond, though, to the albeit limited evidence of some assaultive behavior by the alleged perpetrator?
The evidence that was presented regarding that, first, they are isolated and separate incidents which occurred months apart. Name-calling, I do not believe, rises to the level of family violence, assault, or any type of thing that would have made a mother aware that this person could be a harm. Then you flash forward several months, and there was a minor altercation, which for all the evidence showed and was testified to, that it was a minor push match between two adults. Now, that, I do not believe, rises to the level of believing that harm could come to a child. Based on the evidence that was also presented, in that course of 7 months, the child had been regularly cared for by the alleged perpetrator and no harm had come to the child. And there had been no instances that would have alerted this mother that there was concerns. And additionally, best interest must also be looked at. This, on the other hand, where D and E are a snapshot backwards, best interest is a snapshot forward. All the evidence presented in trial showed from the counselor, from the CASA advocate, from the CPS caseworker, that this mother had made leaps and bounds forward in her positive outlook, her just emotional status from the time of the removal to this. She had overcome many of her personal struggles because she had come from a significantly abusive home. And she had gotten housing, had really made a life that she had not previously been able to do during the course of this case. The court referenced Green versus TDPRS. However, I believe that this is very clearly distinguishable in the fact that the mother in our case did not do any of the very apparent and clear acts of violation of the best interests of the children. This mother worked hard on our services, did not allow the perpetrator back in the home. Granted, the perpetrator, she actually worked very diligently with the police to apprehend the perpetrator, and was instrumental in them locating him. He is a Mexican national who is here illegally, and I believe that without her assistance in locating him, he would have made it back to Mexico and would have never come to trial on this injury to a child. And as far as the grounds for O failed to comply with a court order, I do not believe that any of the evidence shown at trial showed that that the mother was that she failed to comply with the court orders. She had housing. She had been selling Mary Kay. She had been taking odd jobs cleaning homes. She had done her services, counseling, parenting, made her visits. She had been working on her immigration issues so that she could have legal work and so that she would not run the risk of being deported.
So really she met all but having employment.
Yes, Your Honor. And she did have hit and miss employment through selling Mary Kay, which was she had done throughout the case. And then she also was working on a cash basis, occasionally helping out friends by cleaning their homes.
And what about the termination as to the new baby?
Your Honor, at this point, that case is actually ongoing. We were set for jury trial to begin today. On Friday, the court, based on our request, has granted a six-month extension pending the outcome of this case due to the fact that the grounds on the second child are wholly based on the finding of DNA on this child.
Okay.
And as far as also the immigration status, the mother did actually receive her legal status in October, which would have, if this extension had been granted, would have been within that 180 days of extension. We believe that the mother was denied due process and equal protection under the law based on the fact that her service plan required her to choose whether to violate the law or complete the service plan. If she became employed using a false social security number or other means, then she could have been deported and therefore would have lost all contact with her child. If she didn't get employment, then she was failing to do as the service plan that CPS had set out for her. And it's clear through even the caseworker's testimony that parents who do not have the proper work authorization typically find it more difficult, if not impossible, to obtain the type of employment that CPS would consider stable. And therefore, this group is far less likely to successfully complete their family service plans than a citizen or somebody who has legal work authorization would have. And I believe that the best interest issue that we are addressing with this is that this mother is not perfect. This mother cannot offer what possibly this foster family could. And I believe that the testimony presented and a lot of the response brief regarding what the foster family can provide for this child versus what the mother can provide is improper based on the fact that parental rights are precious and best interest should not come and should not be determined based on who can offer the most. This mother had worked very diligently on her service plan, continued to work diligently through her pregnancy and through many obstacles that were presented to her through her legal status in the United States. And she was able to show the state that she was willing to jump through the hoops that were set forth in that family service plan. And I believe that in and of itself shows a mother that is willing to provide for the best interests of the child.
Will you address the requested extension? Beyond, I guess, the 1-year dismissal?
Yes, Your Honor. We requested the 6 month extension, the 180 day of the dismissal date, and the extraordinary circumstances. Extraordinary is not clearly defined in the Texas Family Code. At that point, the court found that there would be no change in her circumstances between the time of the request and the end of the 180 days. As I've noted, in that 180 days, the mother did actually receive her legal immigration status, and therefore has been able to receive legal employment since such time. Therefore, we believed at the time that based on the timing of her appointment with immigration, which was actually the day after trial was set to begin, that she would be able to have legal employment and therefore be able to present to the court her basis for, again, complying fully with the service plan. However, the court did deny the extension, saying that there was no evidence that there would be a change in circumstances between that day and the end of the 180 days.
Can this court even consider that, since that's something that happened after the trial concluded?
Your Honor, that actually, meaning that she received her immigration? Your Honor, I do not know. However, it does show that the circumstances did change in that 180 days, which therefore the trial court saying that no, there would be no change in circumstances, I think it speaks to that. And I believe that 6 months is a world of time when it comes to the service plan, and 6 months of stable employment was what was required, and 6 months is what that extension granted.
I have a question. The foster family the child was placed with,
yes.
And I only want to know what's in the record, okay? The child was placed with a foster family that intended to adopt, is that?
Your Honor, the foster family is what is commonly called a dual licensed home, meaning they are a foster home as well as a potential adoptive home. Therefore, any child that's placed in their home, they have the ability to adopt. There are foster only homes where they are not licensed to, and they haven't already gone through the prerequisites to adopt. So this child was placed in a home that was dual licensed to either just foster or adopt if that became available.
So they placed the child in a foster home that was a potential adoptive family while claiming to be working to restore the child to the mother?
Yes, Your Honor. This is common practice for CPS to do that based on the permanency goals of the Family Code, and it found in 263 that's set out for the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services. They commonly place children in a dual licensed home even when stating on the record and working with the family to reunify.
Are there any statistics that tell us how often the family is actually reunified?
Your Honor, I do not have statistics. I've been working with CPS since 2000 in varying capacities, and it's been my experience that when we're talking about a dual licensed home and we are going to termination, it is most of the time the foster family and their circumstances are used as leverage against the birth family.
All right, thank you, Ms.
Thank
Palmer.
You.
Mr. Witten.
May it please the court, my name is Matthew Witten for the department. The two most important facts in this case are that this young child was beaten to within an inch of her life by appellant's boyfriend, live-in boyfriend. The doctor who examined this child testified that it appeared to him that at the time of presentment to him in the hospital, that these injuries had been there for probably 4 or 5 days. Appellant testified at trial that the child did not have any symptoms until shortly before they took her to the hospital. But that fact is probative of the credibility of the appellant's testimony and the credibility of the other witnesses at trial. Appellant has had a very unstable life. She moved in with her boyfriend, who is not this child's father, after the same day that she met him in person. He called her, pardon my language, a whore that day, and yet she moved in with him because she is entirely dependent on others for her own support and her well-being. That is the pattern of her life, and although that's unfortunate and sad, we're here about the best interest of the child and where this child should be. The evidence in this case is overwhelming that appellant probably knew what was going on with boyfriend beating this child and protected him all the way up until the trial happened. The first time that she was able to say out loud that she thought appellant or that the boyfriend had something to do with this child's injuries was at trial. And she said the reason was, well, it's because he wouldn't say anything. I finally don't believe him. That was really when it looks like she came to that realization. She visited this man in jail constantly in the time up to trial, and although the original goal was reunification, it became apparent that appellant was continuing to protect her boyfriend. She has another child with her boyfriend, as the court knows, that she became pregnant with during the pendency of this case, after this child had been removed. The facts are also clear that it's not just her employment problems leading up to trial that led to termination, especially with respect to subsection O determination. She lived, by her own count, at least 8 different places, entirely dependent on others pending trial. The evidence seems to show it was closer to 14 different places. She sporadically worked. She did not comply with the counseling. She was encouraged to go back to the psychologist that evaluated her. She refused to do that, and there was a group session. She refused to do that again.
So did she miss a specific number of appointments with a psychiatrist or psychologist? Is that in the record?
Yes, it's in the record that she was supposed to go to these group counseling sessions. She told her caseworker that she didn't want to go, that she didn't think it was helping. She was encouraged to do that. She wouldn't do that. And so as far as appellant's sufficiency points, she's been terminated not under just O, but also D&E. And appellant said, with regard to D&E, I believe, that only the facts leading up to this child's hospitalization can be considered in making those determinations. Well, that's just not true. The facts leading up to trial need to be considered. This appellant's continued protection of this man that beat her child, this appellant's noncompliance and refusal to work, inability to provide for herself at all, means that she can't.
How could she work?
Well, she did. She tried to work some.
I thought she couldn't work legally.
No, she can't work legally. Well, apparently she can now that she's gotten her visa.
Well, then how can you hold it against her that she didn't work when it would violate the law for her to work?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
How can you hold it against her that she didn't work when it would violate the law for her to work? Because then you'd say, well, she's a criminal because she's violating the law. And it seems to me that's a
Your Honor, she has not been treated any differently than any other parent in this situation.
Well, if she can't work legally, then...
And it's worth noting, and in fact it's very important, that that's not the only reason she was terminated. There were these many other reasons that I've already discussed. With regard to appellant's constitutional points, I first want to point out that these are not preserved for error. There was no mention at the trial court, at the hearing, in any motion anywhere, not until her brief to this court, that constitutional issues were even mentioned. So it's not necessary for this court to even reach those issues, but if it did, there is no harm because she was terminated under D&E as well and other grounds under O. With respect to the extension of time that she requested to have an additional 6 months to get her work status sorted out. First of all, this service plan that required her to work was entered just about as soon as the case was filed, almost a year before the hearing on her motion. She never brought her immigration status to anyone's attention at the court. There's absolutely no mention of it. Then, very shortly before trial, she files a motion for continuance. The motion for continuance did not mention the immigration issue. And in fact, the motion for continuance, the grounds stated in there was that she was pregnant with boyfriend's child and that she was working on complying with other parts of the order and trying to get caught up. But there was no mention of the immigration status. The first time that's mentioned is immediately prior to trial. The trial court cannot be said to have abused its discretion when it acted with guiding principles with this immigration getting brought up during a hearing, had no warning about, and had some other legitimate concerns. First of all, the father's case was being tried at the same time. Trial court mentioned it was concerned about, and he wasn't there, he didn't show up. The trial court was concerned about continuing in his absence and some possible prejudice to him at the same if he granted the continuance and creating some other possible appellate issue, but also the immigration status didn't have anything to do with why the department was pursuing termination at that point. The reason it went from a goal of reunification to termination, as the witnesses testified, was we've gotten all the way up here. It's clear to the point of trial. It's clear that this woman appellant is continuing to protect boyfriend. We are concerned about the child's well-being. And with regard to, I believe, Justice Stofano, you asked a question about subsection O. It is proper for the trial court and for this court on review to consider the foster family and what they can provide for the child with respect to the child's best interests.
Let me explain my problem.
Okay.
You take the child from the home. You place the child with a prospective adoptive family. And then you say we should compare the circumstances of the prospective adoptive family with the birth mother. That is, we compare the people you've chosen for this child with the circumstances of the birth mother. Presumably, you wouldn't have chosen the family if you didn't think they could provide a better home than the birth mother. How are you seeking to restore the family when you've already chosen another family that you've already decided is a better place for the child?
I can answer that question, but it's outside the record. When the children are placed with foster, and Ms. Palmer explained this actually fairly well, when the children are placed with foster families, many, if not most, of those foster families are families that are also looking to adopt, potentially. Obviously, the child is placed with a family at the time of removal simply because it's a better situation than with the parent. Even if the goal at that time is reunification, if something changes, that family is ready and willing to adopt. Now,
what percentage of children actually go back to the birth mother?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know. I could not give you a number. These families are told, and this is what's outside the record, but these families know, as foster families, that they're not going to have a chance to adopt every child that may come in and out of their home. But when it became clear in this case that that termination and adoption was going to be the goal, this family came and testified, and they are ready and willing to adopt this child. And I don't think there's any dispute that they can provide a good home for the child.
Is there ever a circumstance where if you weigh the resources of the adoptive family against the birth family, if the birth family would, if that's the test we're supposed to apply, is there a circumstance when the birth family is ever in a better position?
Well, it's not the only test. The circumstances of the adoption. I'm sorry.
You've asked us to look at the circumstances of the adoptive family as compared to the circumstances of the birth mother, and this is the adoptive family you've chosen because it's a better, they're better off and can provide more than the birth mother. Would there ever be a circumstance when weighing the resources of the two would ever benefit the birth family?
Those aren't the only facts that the department's asking you to look at. It's among the many facts. I don't know if there's ever a circumstance where if we only looked at the prospective family versus the parent being terminated, you know, I don't know if there's ever a circumstance, but
logically, why would you choose a family that's worse? That would provide less than the birth family.
Well, and at the time of removal, we wouldn't. We try to put them with good ones. But here, it's only one among many factors. It's not the only thing the department's asking you to look at. The department is also asking you to look at the totality of the evidence because this, of course, is a sufficiency review, and we're looking for the whole thing. And the prospective adoptive family is just one of the many pieces of a puzzle. If there are no other questions, I see I'm almost out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Witten. Ms. Palmer.
May it please the court. Briefly, Mr. Witten referenced Dr. Cox's testimony regarding the injuries to the child, which were significant, but it's also very clear through the record that the injuries were that they happened due to the perpetrator, not the mother, and that the mother, by all accounts, by all of the state's witnesses and all of the mother's witnesses, that the mother was not present at the time that the injuries occurred. It's also clear in the record that the mother took the child to the hospital 4 days prior to Dr. Cox's examination of the child.
Was there ever a time after the injuries that the mother allowed the child to be with the boyfriend when she was not present?
No, Your Honor. The child was removed shortly after the child was received at the hospital, and the mother never allowed and was never... and the perpetrator was never allowed to be around the child again. And Dr. Cox's time frame for the injuries occurring, the child would have been seen at another hospital around the time, and Dr. Cox testified and it is in the record, that it is possible that the injuries were not identified at that time just based on the nature of the injuries and the severity needing to kind of rise to a level that it would have taken a more specialized doctor to have identified than what's was seen 4 days prior. Additionally, it's also in the record that this mother not only complied with counseling, but attended more sessions than most CPS parents, and that's testified to by LM, is actually was the mother's counselor, and that was due to her compliance and her making every session and not as many as has been argued as failing to show up for her counseling. The support group is actually in the record, it is a parent support group put together by the Denton County CPS parents. So it's CPS parents supporting other CPS parents. And mother testified that she did not feel that they were helping her because she did not have a drug or alcohol problem and therefore did not find that the support group offered her the type of help that she needed. And additionally, the goal changed April, not even a 2 full months before the termination trial. So I do believe that the record would show that this mother was working very diligently to have her child returned to her.
Is there any evidence in the record about whether the boyfriend was alone with the child before the first trip to the hospital?
Yes, Your Honor. There's evidence regarding that as well from outside, other than the mother, outside witnesses stating that they had seen him with her regularly and that mother had allowed him to provide care on previous occasions when she was either shopping or having other times that she needed to not have a small child with her. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Thank you, Mr. Witten. We appreciate your arguments today. We also appreciate your briefing. Your case is submitted, and you are now excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take just a short recess, and then we'll pick up the next case, which is Leek versus Campbell.
All rise.